the Cambrian, we find tremendously complex creatures. We find the trilobites. We find the swimming crustacean Cydnia. We find branching sponges, jellyfish, brachiopods, sea urchins, sea cucumbers, worms, and other complex animals. These animals are so highly complex, evolutionary geologists believe they would have required nearly 2 to 3 billion years for their evolution. Now, hundreds of these species had hard parts. One thing is certain, they all didn't invent hard parts at the same time if they evolved. Those hard parts must have been evolving for tens of millions of years. Furthermore, we do find fossils of soft-bodied animals in the fossil record, the jellyfishes you see here, worms and things like that, even fossil bacteria, they say. Now, underlying these Cambrian rocks, in many places on the Earth, we have the so-called pre-Cambrian rocks, believed to be older than the Cambrian rock. In many cases, they are undisturbed, identical with the overlying rocks, perfectly suitable for the preservation of fossils. What do we find in pre-Cambrian rocks? Not one single indisputable multicellular fossil has ever been found in a pre-Cambrian rock. According to Dr. Preston Cloud, prominent evolutionist geologist of the University of California at Santa Barbara, not one single unquestionable multicellular fossil has ever been found in one of these rocks. These fossils appear abruptly, and there is no evidence in the fossil record of ancestors of jellyfish, corals, sponges, brachiopods, sea cucumbers, worms, trilobites, and this great variety of very highly complex forms of life. Just as predicted and expected on the basis of special creation, we see the abrupt appearance of these creatures without ancestors. Now, there's a tremendous variety of basically different kinds of creatures here, and there are no transitional forms. Again, the sudden appearance of kind with no intermediate form. Now, we are told that one of these invertebrates evolved into the vertebrates in 100 million years. Ladies and gentlemen, there is not one single transitional form between an invertebrate and the vertebrates, or the fishes. Not one single transitional form. Next slide, please. Are we out of time? All right, I just wanted to show you, just let me point out, there's the fish supposed to be ancestral to the amphibian. There's the old world's oldest amphibian. And you see there is a world of difference. Supposedly the bones and the fins evolved in the feet and legs. But you see, there are three other fins which seem to have bones also, but they somehow got rid of those fins somehow, leaving these to evolve into feet and legs. Now, that amphibian had the basic amphibian limbs, feet and legs. 30 million years involved in this evolutionary transformation. That is a fish, lovely set of fish fins, but no intermediate forms have ever been found. The major fish kinds appear abruptly without transitional forms or ancestors. Thank you very much.
As a historian of science, I'm, of course, fascinated by these arguments. You may not be aware of this, but a very distinguished historian of science, specifically a historian of geology, has stated that the arguments for special creation before Darwin's origin in 1859 were exceedingly strong, and Darwin in the origin feared greatly the reactions of geologists of his time to his work. It's quite clear, I think, from what has been stated by our two friends whose backgrounds are in the sciences, Dr. Morris in hydrology, geology, and mathematics, Dr. Gish in chemistry and biochemistry, that they have assembled a great deal of scientific evidence to support the special creation doctrine. However, you also are aware that modern science in general looks at the subject from a different point of view. They accept doctrines as first enunciated by Charles Darwin, but the arguments which must be presented come in contradiction to the special creation theory must come from geology, and we have Dr. Marion Bickford who is going to speak to that point, and they must come from, shall we say, more specialized areas within geology, paleontology, and we have an ichthyologist who I'm sure is dying to say something about the fish-to-gish theory right now. Would you like to stretch for a moment and then we'll hear from... Just a few minutes. Don't run away.
For the perfect combination of expertise to support, defend, and to attack a particular point of view. I think if we had planned in the beginning, I'm not the organizer of this, I'm simply up here trying to hold things together, but if those who had put this together had planned the four men that we have on stage tonight, they could not have done much better. And now I know that Dr. Wiley is very anxious to speak about the fish, the gish, and I'm going to turn it over to him now.
Ladies and gentlemen, before discussing evolution and creation specifically, I would like to briefly explain my own concept of science in general and scientific theories and hypotheses in particular. Science is a discipline of thought which is made up of a series of statements about the natural world and its process. These statements are called hypotheses, and they are meant to give explanation or partial explanation of the processes the scientist perceives are at work in the world. Some hypotheses, such as most in chemistry, are tested by experiment. Other hypotheses, such as many in biology and all in astronomy, are tested by observation and comparison. Science strives towards truth, yet science is not capable of finding final truth or final knowledge. Therefore, nothing in science can ever be proven in this absolute sense. And whether or not something can be proved in this sense is irrelevant to the discussion. The so-called laws of science are nothing more than hypotheses which have been tested by observation or experiment so many times that no scientist is willing to test them again. But even these laws are not proven fact in the sense of real truth. It is my own personal opinion that this point is misunderstood by many non-scientists. For example, the law of gravity is simply a hypothesis which has been tested so many times that we accept it as an adequate explanation for the process of gravity. Yet, as R.C. Lewontin has stated, the fact that the law of gravity is only a tested and unrefuted hypothesis and not a proven fact does not keep people from flying airplanes for fear they'll fly off the world. It is our job as scientists to strive to separate science from non-science. This is important because we owe it to ourselves and to the general public to make a clear separation between what we say as scientists and what we say as human beings. In other words, what are our scientific deductions and what are our opinions or our beliefs? There are certain characteristics of scientific hypotheses which can and do serve as guidelines to hold the scientist to his science and exclude his personal opinions to the maximum possible, considering that, after all, we are only human. Sir Karl Popper, an acknowledged master in the philosophy of science, has listed some general guidelines which help us in this respect. First, it is easy to obtain results which agree with your theory if you set out to obtain results which agree with your theory. Thus, research designed to prove a point is not necessarily scientific. Every good theory contains certain prohibitions, that is to say, it forbids certain things from happening. A theory which is not refuted by any conceivable event is non-scientific, therefore irrefutability is not a virtue of a theory, but a vice. The key to objectivity in science lies in attempting to refute our theories rather than trying to verify them. Subjectivity lies in the direction of trying to confirm our theories, since confirmations are, after all, very easy to find if we look for them. Finally, some genuinely testable theories, when found to be falsified by observation or experiment, are still upheld by their admirers by introducing ad hoc or auxiliary assumptions, which rescue the theory from refutation. Such a procedure is always possible, but it rescues the theory at the cost of destroying its scientific value. I would also like to add that falsifying a particular theory does not necessarily mean the process behind the theory is also falsified. For example, Newton's theory of physical forces of the universe has been falsified, yet apples still fall from trees and the planets still turn in their orbits. Since we are approaching the question tonight in a scientific rather than a metaphysical or religious manner, I will make the assumption that the scientific creationist doctrine, represents a genuine scientific theory. It does, after all, make certain predictions, give certain explanations, and prohibit certain phenomena from happening. I will therefore assume that scientific creationism is potentially falsifiable through falsification of their predictions or the inadequacies of their explanations, just like any other good scientific theory. Now let's examine the question whether creation is superior to evolution in explaining origins. First, I do not pretend to know the absolute truth about which of these two processes are responsible for origins. Indeed, I'm not convinced that the two are incompatible. There are several theories about the process of evolution. Some give a reasonable explanation for one part of the process. Others give reasonable explanations for other parts of the process. Some theories of evolution give terrible explanations for all of the process. On the other hand, I am sure that there are many theories about the process of creation, and most are religious theories or traditions, not scientific theories. But tonight we are faced not with a religious tradition, such as those of the North American Indians, Hindus, Australian Aborigines, or the Judeo-Christian tradition, but a theory of creation which purports to be scientific, the theory of scientific creationism of Drs. Morris Gish and their colleagues. From now on, when I use creationist, I refer only to that school and theory. Now, when we have two competing systems, one of the best ways of examining them is to put them side by side and examine their basic assumptions, predictions, and explanations. Where their conclusions and explanations differ, we may then ask which is more reasonable. Reasonable, that is, from a scientific point of view. I will briefly do this, but first I would like to discuss several non-issues. Non-issues are issues which are brought up to us as being very important. Yet their importance lies only with the opinion of the speaker and has nothing to do with the scientific merits of the case. The first is the non-issue of the first cause. Many evolutionists, my partner included, believe in the first cause. Belief in first cause is not incompatible with belief in evolution. The issue here is not first cause, but final cause, the almost instantaneous creation of a perfect universe. The second non-issue is the issue that states that since neither creation nor evolution can be proved, both should be considered as viable alternatives and taught that way. But science is not capable of truth. The real question is, can either creationism or evolution be falsified or disproven? The third non-issue is prediction. One does not predict things that have already happened, nor can one say that their theories predicted things which were known beforehand. Also, predictions without adequate explanation have no weight in science. For instance, it is my own personal opinion when Dr. Morris talks of the creation model predicting the second law of thermodynamics, what he really means is that it conforms to the second law of thermodynamics. But in the rebuttal, we'll tell you why evolution does too. Now let's look at the so-called predictions of scientific creationism and evolution side by side. It's presented on page 13 of Scientific Creationism, edited by Dr. Morris. I will take the so-called predictions of the creation model at face value. Some of the so-called predictions of the evolution model are, to say the very least, highly inaccurate, a fact no doubt caused by misunderstanding. I will correct these inaccuracies so you and the audience will be better able to compare the two models. First, the creation model predicts the structure of natural law is invariable. Now, the creationists say that the evolution model predicts that the structure of natural law is constantly changing. This is curious because scientific creationists also claim that evolutionists embrace the principle of uniformitarianism. And uniformitarianism dictates that natural laws are invariable. The creationists cannot have it both ways. Either evolutionists or uniformitarianists, or they are not. The so-called first prediction of the so-called evolutionary model is flatly inaccurate. Interestingly enough, of course, Dr. Morris embraces uniformitarianism on page 224 of his Genesis Flood, but uniformitarianism after the flood only. The second prediction is that galaxies are constant. This is what the creationists say. Galaxies don't change. They claim that evolutionists claim that galaxies change into other types of galaxies. This is another inaccurate prediction. Although cosmologists do think that galaxies change, at least in the sense that they rotate, if nothing else, opinion is divided amongst cosmologists as to whether one type of galaxy changes into another type of galaxy. I suggest the gentleman look up the modern cosmological thoughts. Creationists say that stars do not change into other types of stars. They claim that evolutionists say that stars do change into other types. This is an accurate prediction. If I may have the first slide, please. Furthermore, there is actual evidence which falsifies the creation prediction and verifies or corroborates the evolutionist position. First slide, or lights. My example is a beautiful Crab Nebula in the constellation of Taurus the Bull. Through direct observation, it has been established that the gases which make up the Crab Nebula are expanding at the rate of 600 miles per second. Now, in 1054 AD, the Chinese observed a huge supernova, or a huge exploding star, in the constellation of Taurus. If we calculate backwards in time, based on the rate of expansion of the Crab Nebula, we see that the gases come to a point in 1054 AD, the same time the Chinese observed their supernova. Thus, the Crab Nebula is a remnant of an exploding star, but it is not the only remnant, for at the position where the gases came together, there's a small neutron star. Thus, a star changed into a supernova, which changed into a nebula and yet another type of star, a neutron star. Direct falsification for scientific creationism, direct verification for evolution. May I have the lights, please? Creationist fourth prediction is that other heavenly bodies are breaking down. They say that evolutionists claim that other heavenly bodies are building up. The prediction is so vague I can't discuss it, but perhaps Drs. Morris or Gish would like to discuss it in the rebuttal. The fifth is that the creationists claim that the types of rock formations are the same in all ages. They say evolutionists claim that the rocks are different in different ages. I'm not a geologist, but I've never heard a geologist claim that pure Cambrian siltstone is fundamentally different from pure Cretaceous siltstone, except in the fossils they contain. Indeed, how can an evolutionist predict such a thing under the all-embracing tentacles of uniformitarianism? The evolutionist prediction is inaccurate, and I've corrected them. Now, the sixth prediction concerns the origin of life. The creationists say life comes only from life. They say that the evolutionists say that life comes from non-life. I'm not sure what this means. Does it mean that evolutionists postulate that spontaneous generation is occurring now? Or does this relate to the origin of life? Through a transformation of a complicated non-replicating molecule into a complicated self-replicating molecule. I know no evolutionist who postulates that life is originating now. We do, however, postulate that life originally came from non-life in the primeval world. Of course, the creationists must also believe that life came from non-life, but of course they use the omnipotent creator as the touchstone for producing the first life. Both conjectures are untestable, thus neither prediction can be used as evidence for or against either creation or evolution, scientifically. Prediction 7, the creation model, says that there are distinct kinds of organisms. And they claim that the evolutionists say that there is a continuum of organisms. But wait, ladies and gentlemen, these are not comparable predictions. If the creationists want a real comparison, then they should postulate that the evolution model predicts indistinct kinds of organisms, whereas the creation model predicts distinct kinds of organisms. For after all, ladies and gentlemen, you can have a continuum and still have distinctness. Are not all of you a part of the continuum of your family lines, yet are not all of you distinct individuals? No evolutionist I am aware of has ever stated that there are not distinct kinds of organisms. There is continuity in the sense of reproductive ties stretching back, we say, to the origin of life. But as Eldridge and Gould has stated, this continuum has been split or punctuated from time to time to produce distinction between types. And by the way, this is an evolutionary hypothesis which explains gaps in the fossil record, but I'll get to that later. Prediction 8 of the scientific creationist school says that new kinds of life are not appearing. They say that the evolutionists say that new kinds of life are appearing. Well, I don't know how I can really discuss this unless we know what kinds are. We would predict as evolutionists that new species are appearing, yet Dr. Gish has told us that new species are not really the kinds he's talking about. But what are kinds? And if kinds are undefinable, how can the prediction be used to test either model? The creationists, in their prediction 9, predict that mutations are harmful. The evolutionists predict, the creationists say, the evolutionists predict that mutations are beneficial. The evolutionist so-called prediction is completely inaccurate because it would leave you with the taste in your mouth that evolutionists think that all mutations are beneficial. Nothing could be further from the truth, with a little t, not a capital T. No evolutionist has ever suggested the majority of mutations are beneficial. Indeed, most of our most eminent evolutionary geneticists, like Dobzhansky, Mueller, Fisher, and others, have always maintained that the vast majority of mutations which produced observable changes in the looks of organisms are harmful. However, as Kimura, Otto, and many of their colleagues have experimentally demonstrated, many mutations that occur in genes are neutral in their effect, neither harmful nor beneficial. Thus, evolutionists would claim that mutations will mostly be either harmful or neutral, and perhaps will have an occasional beneficial gene. But since the creationists predict, and I quote from page 55 of Scientific Creationism, they will be harmful, not beneficial, and since there is both experimental and observational evidence to conclude that many, if not all, mutations are neutral, I score another falsification of the creationist theory. Category 10 concerns the age of the Earth. Dr. Bickford will discuss this. I may say that the creationist prediction in scientific creationism is that the Earth is probably young. Dr. Morris does not settle on a final date in his book, The Genesis Flood, but he allows it might be as early as the Earth might be as young as 10 or 12,000 years old. Dr. Bickford will discuss this. I find his arguments compelling, and a priori, I will score another falsification of the creationist theory. Category 11 concerns natural selection. Creationists say that natural selection will be conservative. The creationists say that evolutionists say that natural selection is creative. Now, here's a really valid point against several evolutionary theories. But I hasten to add that it was evolutionists who first attacked these theories scientifically, not creationists. For example, Huxley and G.G. Simpson have in the past stated that any systematic change occurring in natural populations should be termed natural selection. But even Simpson maintained that natural selection could be conservative as well as creative. Surely, if natural selection was viewed this way by all evolutionists, it would be for the evolutionists what the omnipotent creator is for the creationists. But Simpson's viewpoint is shared by only one school of evolutionists. And quite frankly, I think that school is doomed to be replaced. For example, Loubtrup, in his book Epigenesis, concludes that evolution must be a conservative force. Susumu Ono, in his book on evolution by gene duplication, concludes that natural selection is only the policeman of the genome and that it must be viewed as conservative. The point I would like to make is that only one of many of the theories of evolutionary process views natural selection as being creative. The old theories of evolution, while the newer and more current theories view it as being conservative. The creationist deduction for the evolutionary prediction is inaccurate. Category 12 concerns systematic gaps in the fossil records. The creationists say that systematic gaps will be found in the fossil records. The creationists claim that the evolutionists say that there must be innumerable transitions. Indeed, you've just heard 30 minutes of innumerable transitions. The prediction of the evolutionist model is accurate for one theory, classical Darwinianism. Eldridge Gould has stated that a lack of innumerable transitions has, and I quote, stood as the bulwark of anti-evolutionist arguments. Darwin's attempt to explain a lack of many transitional forms was very reasonable 117 years ago. It is not reasonable now. Eldridge Gould would agree that those theories that postulate no gaps in the fossil record have been falsified by the fossil record itself. Thus, that poor old classical Darwinian theory has been falsified. But does this also refute the process of evolution? Of course not. It only means that one theory, one estimate of the truth, was simply wrong. Darwin, like Newton, was an excellent scientific investigator and produced an excellent scientific theory, which failed to explain everything in nature. But if the gaps are real, how did they originate? Eldridge and Gould have one part of the picture. The original ancestral population is split into two daughter populations. Then, for small changes, perhaps the neo-Darwinian synthetic theory can produce small changes. The changes between coyotes and dogs are black moths and white moths. But this certainly doesn't tell you about the gaps between higher taxa, say between echinoderms and vertebrates, which, by the way, Dr. Ted Eaton would probably like to challenge these men on the transitions between echinoderms and vertebrates. He has a very nice organism which fits right in the gap. There are at least four evolutionary theories which attempt to explain gaps between the so-called kinds or higher taxa. Yet I find only one, Goldschmidt's, has been discussed extensively here tonight. The first is the synthetic theory, which admits that small changes observed between species can accumulate over time to produce larger gaps, say, between genera or families, or perhaps even phyla. This is what I call the extrapolation theory. Now, Goldschmidt suggested that large systematic changes in chromosomes, or in what we term functional genes, produce the large morphological gaps. Functional genes are the genes which produce the amino acids and enzymes which actually carry out the functions of your body from day to day. But no such mutation has ever been observed. Indeed, bacteria and man share at least 95% of these functional genes. 95%, exactly similar between bacteria and man. Goldschmidt lacked a convincing genetic mechanism, and his hopeful monster theory was refuted, and rightly so. Now, if these what we call prokaryotes are bacteria, and these eukaryotes, like vertebrates and man, are so doggone similar in their functional genes, then how do we explain how different they are from one another? It must be that these functional genes are used in different ways. What makes a man is not the number of functional genes he has, but the way these genes are used in his development and growth. To be used in complicated ways, these genes must be controlled by other genes, and controlled precisely lest the organism die. At one stage in development, many functional genes must be told to work, and there are controller genes which do this. The difference between a bacteria and a man on the developmental level is that man has thousands of more controller genes which can coordinate the function of the functional genes in very complicated ways. And each controller gene must be able to coordinate perhaps as many as 100 or even 1,000 functional genes at one time. A simple mutation of one of these controller genes would vastly affect the development of the organism. It would produce an instant gap. Susumu Ono suggests that is either new controller genes, the production of new controller genes via what we call gene duplication, or the mutation of existing controller genes, which produces the gaps we see between higher taxa. Soren Lufttrup embellishes on this theory by adding that the earlier in development this controller gene works, the more radical the change would be in the adult. Of course, if change produced an organism which could not develop properly, the policeman of natural selection would weed it out of the gene pool. Now, I would not claim that any of these theories are true. Indeed, the theory of Ono and Lufttrup are so new that they have not even yet been critically tested and are only now being brought to the attention of evolutionists. Indeed, the theory of Ono and Lufttrup are so new that they have not even yet been critically tested and are only now being brought to the attention of evolutionists. The point is that new and potentially powerful evolutionary theories have been and continue to be proposed by evolutionary biologists to explain gaps. The old theories, such as classical Darwinism, are recognized by most to be deficient or falsified, and we in science make no excuses for falsified theories. New questions must be asked and answered. This does not mean that evolution is wrong, and especially it does not mean that we should march backwards and embrace the falsified theory of scientific creationism. What it does mean is that evolutionary theory is still a healthy new science, an exciting intellectual pursuit. I would now like to say a little bit about the geologic column. The evolutionary process, if it is true, should produce genealogical series of ancestors and descendants. Organisms will be preserved when preservation is permitted and fossilized. As a rule of thumb, ancestors will be found lower in parts of the column than their descendants, and groups of organisms which evolved earliest will first be found in lower parts of the column than groups which evolved later. And, of course, groups which evolved earlier and survived will be found right along with those things which evolved later. The creationist must give an adequate explanation for the geologic column, and I would suppose in terms of the 61-day flood of the Yowes tradition, the 375-day flood of the Priestley tradition, or the 375-day flood of Dr. Morris. But a prediction without adequate explanation... Oh, I'm sorry. Now, they claim that the creation model predicts the features of the geologic column, but as I said earlier, a prediction without an explanation is meaningless. Let us examine the explanation for the occurrence of organisms in the geologic column outlined on page 118 to 120 of the book Scientific Creationism, edited by Dr. Morris. The creationists maintain that fossil communities represent ecological communities of the pre-Diluvian world, a reasonable explanation. The creationists maintain that the simplest of each kind of organism will be found earlier in the geologic column because, and I quote from page 119, in the marine strata where invertebrates were fossilized, these would tend locally to be sorted hydrodynamically into assemblages of similar size and shape. Furthermore, as the turbidly upswelling waters and settlements settle back down, the simpler animals, more spherical or streamlined in shape, would tend to settle out first because of lower hydraulic drag. Thus, each kind of marine invertebrate would tend to appear in its simplest form at the lowest elevation, and so on. But wait. If the geologic appearance of organisms is dictated by hydrodynamic forces, then we would expect the simplest of all the kinds of organisms to be at the lowest part of the column, and not the simplest of each kind of organism. In other words, we would expect all the organisms at the bottom of the Cambrian to be spherical or streamlined. Yet this is not so. All kinds and shapes are found in the lowest part of the column. Further, some of the simplest kinds of trilobites are found in the highest parts of the geologic column where they occur. This explanation is flatly rejected by the evidence. Furthermore, it is incompatible with their own assertion that fossil assemblages will represent ecological communities. How can you have hydrodynamic sorting and maintain ecological communities? They cannot have it both ways. How about marine fishes? The scientific creationists said that marine fishes are found first in the higher parts of the column because they lived at higher elevations and could escape burial longer. Now, as an ichthyologist, I'm not aware of any marine fish that has ever lived at an elevation higher than sea level. Even more curiously, these marine fishes are found in the same rocks at the same level with a wealth of marine invertebrates which were not supposed to be able to escape burial as well, and which I suppose lived at lower elevations. Scientific creationists explain the late occurrence of birds and mammals by saying that they had different habitats than amphibians and reptiles, and because of their greater mobility. The greater mobility of birds is self-evident. They can fly. And they are rare, and I quote, because, quote, only occasional exhausted birds would be drowned and trapped in the sediments. I would suggest that the mammals, I would suppose that the mammal's greater mobility was manifested in mountain climbing to escape the flood. Or perhaps I'm mistaken, and either Dr. Morris or Gish would set me straight. Interestingly, large assemblages of fossil mammals would be found, say the scientific creationists, because of the instinctive tendency of higher animals to congregate in herds during times of crisis. And since larger mammals climb better, they would escape burial for longer periods of time and be found at the highest levels. Finally, we come to man. Now, if the world was created perfectly, the man of the pre-diluvian world must have had quite a civilization. Indeed, this is a prediction of scientific creationism. How do they explain the late appearance of man in the fossil record and the lack of his advanced civilization? I quote, "Man would escape burial for the most part, and after the waters receded, their bodies would lie on the ground until decomposed. The same would apply to their lighter structures and implements, whereas heavier metallic objects would sink to the bottom and be so deeply buried in the sediments they would probably never be discovered." Ladies and gentlemen, I leave it to you to decide if these are reasonable explanations. Let me summarize, okay? In summary, ladies and gentlemen, I find the scientific evidence compelling. Of the 12 major predictions of scientific creationism, 5 are exactly the same as the evolutionary model. 4 differ from the evolutionary model, and these 4 predictions are flatly falsified by observation and experiment. The evolutionary model gives a reasonable explanation for occurrence of major groups of organisms in the geologic column. The explanations of the creationist model conflict with each other, and I find them to be nothing but ad hoc and at sometimes rather wild auxiliary assumptions designed to save their theory. The scientific creationists are arguing against evolutionary theories which most evolutionists, well, I won't say most, which many of us no longer believe. They are truly like Don Quixote fighting windmills. Thank you.
Determine the times in millions of years when various organisms appear in the record. May I have the first slide? I think you're going to have to run through 2 of Dr. Wiley's, which didn't get shown. While you're doing that, I have a few other comments I want to make. Ladies and gentlemen, I have a qualification for participating in tonight's debate, which was not mentioned during the introductions. In addition to being a scientist with experience in radiometric dating techniques, I'm a Christian. I find no problem in being a scientist and a Christian. Rather, I'll wait till that beautiful earth comes on there. Rather, I see a great wonder in the ancient and beautiful earth and in the remarkable record of evolution, of life, of rocks, of the oceans, of the atmosphere, and even of the continents themselves. All these things reflect the glory of the Earth's creator. You see, I'm a creationist of sorts. I just can't accept a limited view of what was created and how all of these creations have evolved through the great expanses of time. The record of Earth's history is often exquisitely preserved for the man who's trained to study it. Surely no one can study this remarkable record without glimpsing God. May I have the lights now, please? May I have the lights? Yeah, good. Man has wondered about the age of the earth for a long time. By the last part of the 18th century, it was clearly observed that sedimentary rocks contained fossil organisms, and that where the same rocks were observed, they contained the same fossils. Other sedimentary rocks contained different fossils. Soon the science of stratigraphy was well developed, and it became clear that a great thickness of such sedimentary rocks had been deposited on the Earth's crust. Before the magnitude of the thickness could be approximated, it was necessary to show that some rock sequences, studied perhaps in different continents, were the same. It was necessary to show that some rock sequences studied perhaps in different continents were the same, whereas others were different. Once this was done, the total sedimentary rock column was seen to be on the order of about 80 miles, and this was recognized as a minimum. Now, soon the early workers who studied sedimentary rocks recognized that these rocks were deposits of rivers and streams and waves and other erosional and transportational agencies, in the low places on the Earth's crust, mostly in the shallow parts of the ocean basins. They were thus able to apply known measured rates of sedimentation, the rate of delivery of such material to the sedimentary basins, to the total thickness of sedimentary strata which they had observed on the Earth. These calculations led to a minimum age somewhere on the order of 150 to 200 million years. And everyone recognized that this was a minimum because it was clear that all of the rocks deposited on the Earth had probably not been discovered. May I have the next slide, please? Now, one might claim that some of this total rock record actually duplicates other parts. I think that's going to come in a minute. That's going to be the Grand Canyon. One might claim that some parts of this total rock record duplicate other parts, and that there is difficulty in correlating sedimentary strata from one part of the Earth to another, since this is largely done on the basis of the contained organic record, that is, the fossils. But there certainly are places, like the Grand Canyon, you see here, where 16,000 feet of sedimentary rocks lie exposed, deposited one upon another without any faults or other mechanical breaks. Unless one believes that somehow these deposits, which are completely similar in detail to deltas, coral reefs, beaches, other kinds of deposits in modern-day seas, unless one believes that these were deposited at some extraordinary rate, these deposits alone record tens or hundreds of millions of years of Earth history. Lights, please. In the last part of the 19th century, Lord Kelvin, who was the preeminent physical scientist of his day, a brilliant person, set out to calculate the age of the Earth. Lord Kelvin decided to do this on the basis of cooling rates. Kelvin made certain assumptions about the initial temperature of the Earth, and then he calculated the rate of heat loss, that is, heat flow, from measurements which had been made by that time in deep wells and in mines and things like that. In other words, he knew the rate at which heat was flowing from the Earth's hot interior to the exterior. He made a number of assumptions for initial temperature and found that the age he got was not very sensitive to assumptions of initial temperature, and he found that the age of the Earth, based on this sort of calculation, was between 24 and 40 million years. Now, notice that this is an age which is much younger than the previously done geological estimates. It was less than the age which would be required by the total thickness of sedimentary strata, for example. I'm telling this story partly because I want to make a point about how science works. Within a few years of the publication of Lord Kelvin's data, the French scientist Henri Becquerel discovered radioactivity. Radioactivity is a heat-producing process. Kelvin didn't know about radioactivity. By 1905, the British scientist John Joly had published a book called Radioactivity in Geology, which pointed out that radioactivity, since radioactivity is a heat-producing process, and since the Earth now contains several naturally occurring radioactive elements, these would be elements like uranium, thorium, potassium, rubidium, to mention a few, and that the early Earth must have contained many much greater quantities of these elements since they are decaying, that Kelvin's calculations had neglected a source of internal heat, and thus they had yielded an age which was far too low. Now, there's an important comment I want to make here about science. And that is that we don't look at Lord Kelvin and say that he was stupid. We don't say that he was wrong in his approach to science. He didn't know about radioactivity. Many of the things that we think about the age of the Earth or about evolution, or for that matter about scientific creationism today, we may change tomorrow when someone discovers something new. Now, once radioactivity had been discovered, may I have the lights in the next slide, please? Once radioactivity had been discovered, it was very quickly realized that a new and very insignificant tool was available for the measurement of the ages of objects in the Earth. I've made this slide which I hope doesn't insult your intelligence. It's a very trivial, simple kind of analogy to illustrate how radioactive decay is used to measure the ages of rocks. Suppose, if you will, that I promise you that I will stand here and drop marbles in a basket, which I have sitting up here on this lecture podium, at the rate of one marble every 30 seconds. And you go about your business, you go out and get a drink of water, and you come back in, and you ask yourself the question, how long was I away? All right, if you look in the basket in the first case up here and you find that there are 10 marbles in the basket, you can calculate rather quickly that you were gone for 5 minutes. As long as I continue to drop the marbles at the rate of one every 30 seconds. If there were 120 marbles in the basket, you would have been out for an hour. In the second illustration, I've simply changed the rate. The rate is now 3 marbles every 30 seconds, and if you had been gone for 5 minutes, you would find 30 marbles in the basket, and after an hour, there would be 360. A trivial example, but it illustrates how the radioactive decay process can be used for geochronological studies. What one does is to examine rocks, total rocks or minerals, and measure the total number of daughter products, that is, the products of radioactive decay. And since the rates of that radioactive decay are known, they can be measured, one can calculate how long it took for that amount of daughter product to accumulate. May I have the next slide, please? I'd like now to discuss for just a few minutes some of the modern techniques of geochronology, what some of the limitations are, what kinds of criteria the samples must meet, and how the process can be evaluated. First of all, by analogy with the marbles in the basket sort of thing, clearly the rate of radioactive decay must be constant. If while you were out I had changed the rate of dropping the marbles, then the number of marbles in the basket wouldn't bear any reasonable relationship to the length of time you were gone. Secondly, the samples which are analyzed must have been closed chemical systems since the time of their formation, if what we measure is to have any meaning. In terms of the basket, I suppose we could say that if the basket has a hole in the bottom and some of the marbles leak out, then we will make a low estimate of the length of time that the marbles have been accumulating. And finally, the analyst must be able to determine amounts of original daughter products. For example, you might ask the question, in the case of the marbles in the basket, whether or not there were any marbles in the basket to begin with, before I started dropping in some new ones. This would be an analogy for that sort of thing. Now, I'd like to discuss these things one at a time. Let's start with the constancy of the rate of radioactive decay, because our debating opponents have raised this question in a number of their publications. First of all, the rate of radioactive decay is a function of the structure and the binding forces of the nuclei of radioactive atoms. It is different for each radioactive species. Ladies and gentlemen, no one can prove that decay rates have not changed through time. As Dr. Wiley has made clear, no scientist would claim this. We can't go back in time and prove that radioactive decay rates have not changed. However, consider the following. First of all, the environmental effects, that is, temperature, pressure, chemical environment, and so on, that samples in the Earth could experience are completely negligible compared to the enormous forces in the nucleus, and these effects have never been observed to alter decay rates. Secondly, there exists a very, very large number of age determinations which are completely consistent with geological criteria. If decay rates have varied, then those of several radioactive elements have done so in just such a way as to make ages calculated from them agree and be consistent with geological data. With regard to the second point, it is likewise impossible to prove that rocks or minerals have remained closed chemical systems. However, the great chemical similarities of rocks of similar types and geological environment and of varying ages suggest that, except for rocks extensively weathered at the Earth's surface or those greatly altered at igneous contacts or in mineralized areas, rocks remain at least mostly closed chemical systems. Now, most geochronologists, certainly myself included, have encountered samples which display open system behavior. And we recognize that such behavior generally makes the sample appear too young, not too old, too young, since it is the daughter element which will be chemically or thermodynamically unstable and will therefore be lost the most readily. Again, one must cite the large number of geologically consistent and reasonable age measurements as indicating that samples which are closed systems, or nearly so, can be found. Of course, one can search the literature and find unreasonable and inconsistent numbers which have been published. No one's perfect, and people do publish bad numbers. Now, I have some comments on original daughter determinations. This gets a bit technical. I've got a slide prepared for it. I think I'll save it for the rebuttal period if it's brought up or if anybody turns out to be interested in it. Let me say for now that the matter of initial daughter products is routinely handled by persons who work in this field. Can I have the next slide, please? Let's just skip that one. That's the one about the daughter products. Yes. This is a very complicated, very noisy sort of picture. I apologize for that. That's the only one that I could get my hands on quickly that showed what I wanted to show. On all continents, there are what are called shield areas. These are shown in the patterns of dots, the stippled areas on all the continents. All continents have these. Shield areas are widely thought to represent the proto-continents or the beginnings of continental evolution, ladies and gentlemen. And on every continent, the ages of the rocks of shield areas are consistently 2.6 to 3.6 billion years all over the Earth. Now, I want to point out that fossils of primitive organisms, for example, the blue-green algae, have been found in rocks of the shield areas with ages in excess of 3 billion years. May I have the next slide, please? I have a picture of one of these very ancient rocks. This rock is called the Morton Gneiss. The picture I took here is from a small quarry. The Morton Gneiss is exposed near Morton, Minnesota, in the Minnesota River Valley. This rock has been dated at 3.6 billion years, and it's the oldest known rock on the North American continent. Our rocks have been found in western Greenland, which now yield ages of 3.7 billion years by both uranium-lead and rubidium-strontium techniques. I'd also like to comment that the ages of modern and ancient mountain belts are variable, but they are consistent within each belt. And it has been possible through application of these techniques to map out places on the Earth's crust where, at various times in the past, mountain systems were developed. Next slide, please. Here's a famous map that many of you may have seen from the National Geographic, which purports to show what the Atlantic Ocean, the North and South Atlantic Oceans, would look like if you pulled the plug, drained all the water away. My point here is that the ocean basins, or the ocean floors, are young. No rock older than 200 million years has ever been found in any of the ocean basins. Ocean basins are now understood to form from the spreading or separation of great rocky plates, which are 100 to 150 kilometers thick, with subsequent eruption of new basaltic rock along the ridge in the middle of the ocean basin to form new crust. Note that no fossils dating before the Permian period, which is about 250 million years ago, have ever been found in the ocean basins. I think this argues against an act of special creation. Next slide, please. Finally, the isotopic composition of lead in the earth and in the meteorites and from lunar rocks is consistent with an age of the solar system of 4.5 to 4.6 billion years. This slide shows isotopic analyses of lead. The x-axis is plotted the ratio of lead-206 to lead-204, lead-207 to lead-204 on the y-axis. Both these lead isotopes are the radiogenic daughters of uranium isotopes. These are plotted for a number of meteorites, which have been collected on the Earth's surface. Down at the extreme lower left, those are iron meteorites, and then the ones that come on up this, the other way are stone meteorites. The slope of that line yields a calculated age of 4.5 to 4.6 billion years. And one can show that lead from the Earth plots on the same line, lead from lunar samples plots on the same line, and one may conclude that the Earth and the solar system and the meteorites and everything in it were formed at about that time. I also want to point out that the ages of the periods, I guess we can have the lights on, please. Thank you. I want to point out that the ages of the periods of the Paleozoic and Mesozoic eras have been measured. This record of fossil-bearing rocks goes back at least to 600 million years. But remember that fossils are known from long before this. This record is not consistent with creation. In summary, I'd like to say that the Earth is old. There is time for the origin of life from very primitive organic molecules, and for that primitive life to evolve into higher forms such as man. The record is there for man, evolved in God's image, and endowed by evolution with a superior intellect to study and understand. It's a wondrous record of creation and evolution. Why is it necessary to attempt to refute all this evidence and cram Earth history into only a few thousand years? Why make creation less than it is? Thank you.
You're an extremely patient audience. Well, we have a great deal of food for thought. We'll give you 5 or 10 minutes to stretch and relieve yourselves and et cetera. And then we'll go into...